Good morning.
Morning, everyone. Oh, it's 5 o'clock here. So how's everyone doing today? So my name is Mark Simos. This is Aaron Margosis. We are both members of the Microsoft cybersecurity team. We're going to be talking to you today a little bit about Pass the Hash. Let me start off with a quick poll. How many of you have actually heard about Pass the Hash? Very cool.
Pretty good.
How many people?
When I was growing up, you know. Well, it was a problem if you didn't pass the hash, if you had some and you didn't pass it. But now it's actually a problem we want to terminate. Even in Washington State where it's legal. Go ahead. Sorry.
For the computer version of Pass the Hash, how many people have witnessed it, experienced it, or seen it on their network and environment? Wow, okay. That's pretty reflective of what we've seen in the real world. Our team does incident response as well as a number of other things having to do with protecting against hackers, responding to them, and recovering from the aftermath. And so I think there's one attack that our incident response guys have seen that didn't actually involve Pass the Hash. So anyway, my name is Mark Simos. I'm a cybersecurity architect. So what that means is I help work with customers on these kinds of problems, scope out projects to help recover, to help defend against these problems. And so that's primarily my role.
I do a lot of, I haven't done any incident response actually, but I'm involved in a lot of Windows internal stuff. Co-author of the SysInternals Administrator's Reference, if anybody's coming to see my SysInternals primer session tomorrow, and invited myself to help out with the writing of the white paper on which this talk is based.
And one of the deepest experts in the US in the user account control or UAC technology, which everybody loves, right? Great stuff. One of the world's experts in that particular technology. So the talk today is going to cover a pretty logical set of basically a logical flow. Talk a little bit about the problem. We're going to talk about the attack scenarios that we typically see the Pass the Hash used in and how it's used. I'm going to do a live demonstration of the tool. Sound cool? Something to keep you awake at 5. And then we're going to talk about the mitigations. And this is going to be directly related to the white paper and how they work, what was the thinking that goes on behind them, and how you can implement it. And we do plan, we only have about 20 or 30 slides, so we'd like you guys, if you have questions along the way, to step up to the mics and feel free to interrupt us as you go. Not directly interrupt, but raise your hand, hey, I have a question. And then we'll talk about kind of the next steps from both the from the perspective of the solving the problem in your environment, as well as what Microsoft is doing next. Okay. Sound good?
Everyone okay with this? Okay, good.
If not, it's his fault. So the Pass the Hash Working Group is not just us, although we were a couple of the co-authors on the paper. It's quite a number of people, some from the internal Microsoft IT department, or ACE team is the security part of the IT department, some folks like us that are working with customers in the field, some of the product group folks, some of the people that architected NTLM and Kerberos as a protocol within the product. So quite a varied group of folks. So the problem that we see in the cybersecurity space, and the way we look at this, is that the internet is a source of a lot of good. You've got all these amazing services. Notice they're all Microsoft's and Microsoft partners, of course. All these sources of value and all these wonderful things that make your life more efficient, faster, social connections with people you haven't known for years. It does a lot of great things for people individually. It does a lot of great things for business. It also connects us everywhere. The internet is everywhere. My wife is from a small village in Thailand in the middle of nowhere, and there's an internet cafe there. There is no way to escape the internet. It connects everyone everywhere. Unfortunately, there's a dark side to that too. It connects everyone everywhere. And what we're seeing is that on the computers that we use every day and the mobile devices and all of the things where our jobs are paid to figure these things out is data. We're doing financial transactions. All of the money went online. Can you think of any monetary transactions today that don't involve something electronically on the internet? Very little is done over cash nowadays. The information that is worth money is all sitting on a PC somewhere, or a mobile device somewhere, or a server somewhere. All of the stuff that's worth anything is on a computer. For an intelligence agency worth their salt, for a criminal organization worth their salt, they have to be in the online hacking business. That is where the stuff that they want is. So we really see this trend growing, and we don't see it abating anytime soon. When we take a look at the headlines and kind of how this trend reflects itself in the events of the day, we see a lot of variety. We see a lot of different organizations hacking for different reasons. There are some extremely active organizations or groups of organizations, but there is not one bad guy. There is not one big bad guy that does everything. There's a bunch of people that are doing things for their own end. A perfect illustration of this, in my mind, is someone is hacking the rainforest, effectively. There's a database, and it controls the quota of who gets to chop down how many trees in Brazil. A logging company hired a hacker to change their quota because they could make money. Hacking has become something that is used in a lot of different places. It's not just for the big corporations or the big government agencies. It's something that's starting to affect all of us because all the stuff that's interesting is on a computer. One of the trends, and this is where we're going to talk about the pass the hash and where it comes in, is we're starting to see the attackers use the legitimate systems against the targets or the organizations that are defending themselves. The middle one there kind of describes a typical pass the hash attack where they steal the credentials of legitimate administrators and then they use the legitimate systems of the corporation or organization and they use that to access the resources. And so it becomes an insider threat. Very rapidly, they go from an outsider to an insider threat. The consequences can be deadly. In most cases, the 99% case, when we go and we respond to incidents and we see activity and we read the headlines, 99% it's data theft. They want data. There's a piece of data that they want, and then they're going to take that and they're going to use it, they're going to sell it, they're going to do something with it to get money out of it or to get some mission objective in the case of a government. In the one, it's actually not one case, it's actually two cases. How many have heard of Shamoon? Oh, wow. So about, what, a year ago?
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, about a year ago. So Saudi Aramco is the national oil company of Saudi Arabia. RasGas is also it's also in the Middle East. It's a Qatari natural gas company. Both of these were hit by a piece of malware that was called Shamoon. And what happened there, based on the profile and the information that we've seen on it, was a pass-the-hash attack that ended differently. The only difference between what happened at those guys and what happened everywhere else is that the bad guys didn't want to steal data. They wanted to burn the network down. And they were very successful at doing that. They got about 3/4 of the Aramco machines, about 30,000 PCs, were wiped. Every single data file was replaced with an animated GIF file of a burning American flag. Every single PC had its boot sector overwritten such that it would not boot, all the ones that were targeted successfully, about 3/4 of them. So imagine going into a corporate office building, floor after floor after floor, of nothing but unbootable PCs with the data erased. The only difference between what happened there and what happens in all the other pass-the-hash attacks that we see is the bad guys wanted to do that. They have that power in every single other pass-the-hash attack that we've seen. Make sense? That's why we worry about this a lot. So pass-the-hash, did you have a comment?
Not yet.
So.
you're doing well.
Got to keep it light. Everybody happy?
We have a question right here. Should get you a microphone. So,
and I'm noticing that there's been a lot more discussion of it. Is it because of that whole the incidents there that's really driving promoting what's going on?
So the question is was it the Aramco incident that's driven awareness of it? I would say that's one of the incidents in sequential order. The first one that really drove the activity and therefore some awareness of it was when the Pass the Hash toolkit was released in, I want to say, 2006. And it took what was a very difficult to execute attack into something that's literally a command line tool, which I'll be showing you guys in a few minutes. So we saw obviously we don't track statistics on every attack because we don't know about them all. People don't disclose them. But we saw a spike, a vertical rise in the amount of attacks because it became easier. It became democratized effectively. And then the attack got even easier with the release of the successor tool, Windows Credential Editor, which I'll be demonstrating. And we saw a lot of activity around there and a lot more awareness come of it. And then the Aramco piece, for the folks that are in the InfoSec industry, that hit home and it hit hard because it wasn't just a theory that it could happen. And yes, you know, we know it could happen. It actually did happen. It happened to an organization that probably had the money to be able to handle it on average, but it actually happened in reality. And that was something that hit home. So when you look at a pass the hash attack, we divide it into two different types of attack activities. And the reason for that is just because the dynamics are so different. It's the exact same technique. It's a credential theft and a credential reuse, but they achieve two different objectives. The first is lateral movement, which is taking a compromised resource, stealing the credentials from that, and compromising resources of the same type, usually configured almost the same way. An elevation of privilege, or privilege escalation, is taking control of a resource as an attacker and then stealing a credential that is of a higher value than that resource, and that would be taken to control that resource. So, for example, controlling a domain admin credential by compromising a user workstation. Make sense?
I think we have a really good graphic.
We do. It's coming up, according to the little preview. So a typical pass the hash attack usually starts in a phishing email. Doesn't have to, but phishing is pretty common. We're actually starting to see an uptrend in watering hole attacks. Anybody here familiar with what a watering hole attack is? Okay. For the folks that don't know, effectively, everybody knows what a phishing attack is, right? Convince someone to click on an email that goes to some arbitrary attack server. Well, in the case of a watering hole attack, instead of having to create this arbitrary attack server that could be filtered out as an unusual piece, what they do is they find places that the users are already going, a watering hole, like, you know, going in the Serengeti and there's a watering hole where you know the animals are going to come, and then staking it out. They compromise that website, they infect it with malware, and then they sit there and they wait for the legitimate users that are going to go there and do their legitimate things. They can even buy an ad on that site and then deliver the malware in that way. And then through the user's normal habits, by going to some unusual phishing site, they go and they compromise them. And so that's a watering hole attack, much like a lion waiting at a watering hole for the gazelles to come and be eaten up.
Yep. And another variant on the phishing email is an email that contains an attachment that contains maybe a malformed Excel spreadsheet, a malformed PDF document, something that triggers a vulnerability in Excel, Adobe Reader, or some other app like that, and starts running arbitrary code on the user's computer and compromises the user's user session.
Yep. And keep in mind that this is not part of the pass the hash attack. This is just the requirement to get that first control of that first machine. So in the phishing scenario, we see a phishing email comes in, goes to a bunch of users. Only one of them needs to click on it. And that machine needs to be compromised. It doesn't just need to be compromised at the user level to run user-level code. It does need to be compromised at the system or administrator level so that they have full control of the machine. And that's what allows the pass the hash part of the attack to start. What happens is they then take the credentials that they've stolen from that machine, they clean it out, and we'll show you the various different places and the kinds of credentials they have, and then they use that to access, in the case of this attack, a lateral traversal attack, the other machines. In the meantime, they're finding out where the domain admin is, and they figure out, okay, this is his workstation. I've even seen comments on computer objects in After Directory that say domain admin workstation. It's happened. And there's other ways they can figure it out by name and such like that. But ultimately, they target, they find that domain admin workstation, they get the domain admin cred, and then at that point, they're sharing control of the domain admin cred, which means they're sharing control of the domain and everything that depends on the domain for security. That includes everything joined to the domain or that uses a domain account to manage it. Once you own the domain database or a domain admin that controls it, you own everything. Or share control of everything would be more accurate. Make
so
sense?
One part of this we want to be clear about is this first movement here that takes over the first workstation, like Mark said, is not pass the hash. You cannot begin a pass the hash attack until you have administrative control over some machine in the environment. Then what it's doing is using credentials, such as, say, it discovers the credentials for the built-in local admin account, and uses those to quietly, without requiring any user action, go laterally, as we saw here and here. Okay?
Move the mouse on the other screen. You're on the preview.
Is it moving? Oh, it's the...
Go left or right. I think it's one... I don't know which side it's on.
Here. Oh. We'll do it this way. This won't show up on the recording, but this part here is not past the hash. This is the compromise. This part is past the hash. Once they gain a foothold with admin rights, they take, for example, the local admin account and use that, because this machine here probably has the same local account, username, and password. They can use that to take over this machine, et cetera. That's the lateral traversal. And then, as he pointed out, at one point here, you find a machine where a domain admin has logged on. Now those credentials can be stolen, and that gives you access to things that only domain admins can have, like control of the domain machine. And that's the privilege escalation variant of pass the hash.
So let me ask a quick question. How many people here in your environment that you work with typically find that every workstation has the same local administrator password? That means they knock over one workstation, they have all the rest automatically, because they can steal the credentials from that authoritative SAM database store and then use those to authenticate to the other workstations or crack them into passwords and use them in that way.
You've got a microphone right there.
Yep.
Thank you.
Does the user that initially got clicked on the message have to be a local administrator, or do they have to have no elevated privileges on their machine in order to basically get that whole thing?
Two choices. If they're already an administrator, they break out of the app, and then they're running as the administrator. So they have to convince the user to hit the little yes button in IE to allow them to run some arbitrary program. Or if they're not an administrator, they have to do that, and then they have to do an elevation of privilege to go from user to admin. So they need an unpatched vulnerability.
A few different ways of getting there. So, if you're running XP, everyone running is admin, or power user, which is admin equivalent, anything that starts running arbitrary code, you've already got admin rights. Or maybe you've got Windows 7 or Windows 8, and you've turned off user account control, and you're running as admin. No problem there. But another thing to remember, though, is with Windows Vista 7, 8, the quote-unquote protected admin, where you're a member of the admins group, but you log on and everything runs as standard user until you click yes. From a security perspective, we consider that admin equivalent, because there's ways you can silently get around having to do the UAC prompt. No legitimate developer will do that, but malware authors can do that. It is not considered a security boundary. Okay, so member of the administrators group is admin equivalent regardless. And so from there, you've compromised the box. But there's lots of other ways. If you've taken over a standard user account, maybe not as easy or as cookie cutter, but there are frequently elevation of privilege problems because of third-party software installed on the computer.
And the fact is, even if they're just a standard user, which is far and above better than being an admin, they're able to run arbitrary code and work on the problem as needed. So, letting any malware running on the machine is a bad thing. But the nice thing about demoting them from admin to user is that they have to fight for it, and they have to come up with something. And if it's a completely patched machine, you're not going to see the exploit for that in the library of the stuff already in the tools. They have to come with a zero day, or they have to find something that you haven't patched. So it raises the bar significantly, it raises the cost. It's not like it just comes with Metasploit, easy to go ahead and do. Make sense?
Yep.
All ready for a demo? You want to see how hard this is? Easy, hard, something like that. So, demo environment is very simple. It's a domain called domain. I actually managed to confuse a program manager in the Active Directory group by actually having a domain named domain. He didn't expect that. But the domain is called domain. The DC is called DC. The client is called client. I'm going to be simulating an attacker that has already taken control of the client computer, and the domain admin is not aware of that fact. So I'm going to log in as the local admin. And so this local admin account is just a local admin account. It's simulating something that's running as system or admin access as malware. And are you guys aware that most of the threats that we see for pass the hash, they're not automated worms or viruses? These are actually attack operators typing commands, getting returns, and doing a human speed attack. In most cases, that's what we're seeing. We're actually seeing organizations, be it intelligence agencies, criminal organizations, that are conducting these attacks, and it's a person going through the steps of these. There's a few things that are automated, but it's not like the blaster or slammer viruses that behave in a certain way and are pre-programmed. These are command consoles that they're sending back to their attack consoles.
In other words, like a remote shell.
Yep.
Or a remote shell, yep.
So as the attacker, I'm going to go ahead and run a command prompt, and I'm now running as admin. I'm going to do a quick net use to the DC. And I'm being prompted for credentials. I've got nothing. So I'm going to switch over to my attack tools, and I'm going to do a WCE. And what that's going to do is, for all of the currently running processes, Windows keeps a single sign-on credential. So when you log on to your machine, you expect, when you go to SharePoint, to Exchange, to a file share, it automatically logs you in, right? You don't expect to get prompted for credentials every time. Well, the reason for that is because the LSASS process holds a copy of your credentials for you in safekeeping and uses those to automatically log you on, so you don't have to be prompted for credentials all the time. And so what these are is the current single sign-on credentials that LSA is holding. One is the local admin account that I'm in now, no gain for the attacker. The other is the local machine account, which, again, I'm in control of the machine, so it's not really a major gain. So what I'll do is... I'll do a WCE-E. Does the same thing, but then it sits there in memory and waits for a logon event. And when someone logs on again, it rescrapes memory and snaps whatever credentials are already there and scrapes those out. So now I'm going to switch over to our unsuspecting domain admin.
So in a typical attack here, you're not going to have a local admin remaining logged on necessarily. At this point, the attacker can install something that runs in the background as a scheduled task or a service and just sits and waits. So it doesn't have to be an interactive session monitoring, waiting for someone else to log on.
It could be a scheduled task, a service, anything that runs a process that would automatically be expected to log on to other machines, which is everything that runs a process, will be there. So I'm going to log on as the domain admin, and at this point, my domain is completely owned. I don't know it. I don't feel it, I don't see it, but it's completely gone. So I'm going to go ahead and switch back over to our hacker session and show you what his perspective looks like. And by the way, you will see these passwords, so you don't have to worry about missing them as I'm typing them. So you can see there, I now have the domain admin credential. And if you look at how that's formed, it's the user account, it's the source of the user account.
Yeah, you got Zoom it?
I do not. I'm one of those people that hasn't figured out how to do Zoom it. I'm a bad presenter. Sorry. But it's basically four different fields separated by colon: username, source of it, whether it's the domain of the local machine, the landman hash, and then the NT hash. And so you may say that these are difficult to use. How would I ever use such an ugly looking thing? Well, I'm not a very good hacker, but I do know how to copy paste. So if I do a WCE-S and then paste that in there, what I've just done is I've instructed through the APIs in the WCE tool, I've essentially replaced my single sign-on credentials for this session I'm in right now with the ones I just copied pasted. So now when I travel on the network, instead of using my credentials and attempting those, it will use the domain admin credentials that I've just stolen. So
let me define these terms just a little bit. This, what you're seeing here, all these hex numbers and everything, is the hash of the password. Okay, that is, for some types of authentication, password equivalent. When you start doing a network logon, it will actually use the hash and start comparing that across the network, across a secure channel. If you're monitoring what's going on the wire, you probably won't see anything that'll actually help you do a replay if you've got reasonably secure settings. But the hash is going to be there in memory in order to conduct this single sign-on event. And
yep. So now when I, with these new credentials, put in that place, in that slot, I can do a net use, and I'm going to go for broke. I'm going to do a map drive to the C dollar sign of the domain controller, and there we go. So now I'm going to go, I'm going to make a hacker tools directory, and if you notice in the background, all the stuff that I'm doing is having an impact on the DC in real time. This is actually happening. I am the domain admin. If I brought up a Active Directory user's computers on this machine, it would do a netlog onto that DC, and I would be able to manage that domain database as the domain admin.
Question? There's a microphone behind you over there.
What if the domain admin was using a smart card? Would he be able to detect that?
If the domain admin is using what?
Smart card, RSA smart card?
Yes. If the domain admin is using a smart card.
So if the domain admin is using a smart card, there's two ways you can do smart card authentication. One is you enable it, and it's also available, and the password still works. And so you simply enable that mapping. The other is that you enforce smart card logon. You check the little box on the account that says, help me out here.
Smart card required for interactive logon.
Thank you. And in that case, he's like an encyclopedia.
I wish I'd known that you didn't know how to use Zoom it earlier, though. Because that would have been easy to fix. I could have...
It's
book.
A carbon-based problem.
You
it's not my, electronic.
Yes, but you have my book, don't you?
Sure.
This is the last time I'm okay. on the stage with this guy.
Okay. So if you do check that box, that smart card required for interactive logon, which we commonly call the SCRIL flag because that's the acronym, what happens is it sets a random NT hash. It's actually not a password that gets hashed. It's a random number value that is 128 bits long. In that case, the hash that you see there can be stolen and reused just the same because it is an NTLM compatible logon. So I need to be able to use Kerberos, I need to be able to use NTLM, I need to be able to use those protocols. So smart cards doesn't natively protect me from that.
Because at some point, it still needs to be converted into a form that can be used across the wire.
And if I own
that
the
form will be a hash.
And if I own the box that translates two-factor authentication into a one-factor authentication protocol, then I can steal the one factor and just reuse that. Make sense?
So, as a comment?
Yeah.
As a comment on that, if anybody's doing any auditing or logging, you, the administrator, just did that.
Say that one more time?
Because if you have any sort of auditing or logging, anything the hacker does will show up in the logs as the administrator doing.
Yes.
Right.
The event logs for these logons show just as if the legitimate administrator logged on. There is no way to tell the difference unless you know that the admin should not be doing that action at that time.
Also point out that there is no event when... my session's hash gets replaced by a different one, right? And I also want to point out that this tool uses no documented or supported APIs. There are none for accessing the hashes that LSAS is managing, okay? There are APIs for enumerating what LSA logon sessions are active on a computer. In fact, there is a sysinternals tool that'll tell you that called logon sessions, but there is none that will show you what the hashes are, let alone replace them. So they're using undocumented internal structures. Some of these tools are probably expecting things in specific memory locations or certain entry points that may or may not be there in the future. But
That reminds me of a legal disclaimer. This is not a Microsoft tool.
Yes.
This is
That's correct.
This is a tool that I downloaded from the web. The signatures for just about every antivirus product do know about WCE, and they will catch it, and they will auto-delete it. I do have to, for this particular demo, I do have to create an exception in that WCE folder so that the demo actually works. But these tools, much like any virus, can be recompiled really easily to avoid a signature. these tools could also be recompiled to avoid a signature very easily. Yep. So
the way you can tell, by the way, that it's not a Microsoft tool is when you run it, it doesn't prompt you with an end user license agreement.
Nice. So do you, so you guys want to see it get a little bit worse?
How about
Smart card with dynamic groups. Marcus mentioned that yesterday.
Yes, that is something that brings you a lot closer to enforcing the two-factor authentication. We haven't finished fully threat modeling that and the various differences. It's a very promising approach that might be a good architecture and design, but it's not something we've proven out yet. So it's not something we've included in the white paper to date.
Yeah. So will that only happen if the user, if the domain admin actually logs onto the machine, or can it happen some other ways, like they go and just like just whack to a drive and take a look at things? You know, it, what actually will trigger capturing that the hash?
Very good question. So there are multiple logon types in Windows. Every logon type save one will cause that to be exposed, because every logon type save one causes a process to be run locally on the machine. The one exception is a network logon. So if I map a drive, if I hit a SharePoint site, if I hit an Exchange server, I'm doing a network logon. It's an authenticated session. It's not a service starting up. It is not a batch job running. It is not an interactive logon that's causing WinLogon and all the other pieces to come up. I think I got all of them. RDP also.
Yeah, so basically, if the credentials are actually entered on the machine through some mechanism, Control-Alt-Delete, password, remote desktop, password, okay, those will put a hash in memory. If you configure a service to run using a domain admin account, that password is going to be stored locally on the machine so that the service control manager can do a logon for that user account and start running a process. Same with task scheduler and use of run as, where you have to type in a password. The one exception, like you said, is a network logon, so a net use where you're using your existing credentials and not entering new credentials, or actually, even if you're using new credentials across the network, it's not going to pass the actual password across, and so it will recognize and authenticate you, but it won't have the hash of the password in memory. So the remote machine, from that point, will not anything running there. If you're a domain admin and you do a net use to another machine, anything that's running as admin can run as domain admin on that machine, which doesn't really gain it anything because it's already admin. But it won't be able to then take those credentials and take them off somewhere else and take another computer.
Yep. So we mentioned the lateral traversal using a local account. There's another tool that we have on here on the C drive. It's called pwdump. There are many, many, many variations of this tool. This is just one of them. You'll notice that when we do that pwdump, that is the SAM database. Same exact format. In fact, it's copy-paste compatible with WCE and a number of other tools, with one exception. There are spaces in it, so you have to put quotes around it. But ultimately, those hashes and those local accounts can be injected and reused at will as well. So they are just as portable. Make sense?
Hey, with regard to UAC and stealth elevation for the local system,
yep.
If you require a password, is the same mechanism for stealth elevation possible?
If you're a member of the administrators group?
Yep, but you require the password for elevation.
Right. Basically, if you're doing something that bypasses the UAC prompt entirely, it doesn't matter whether it's a credential or a standard user one. So, the thing is that there's within that, I don't want to talk about what the actual vulnerabilities may be, but like I said, it's not a security boundary. They know there are ways around it. They just want to keep legitimate developers from doing that and gaining admin when they shouldn't, but we recognize that there will be ways that hackers can. You've got shared surface between the admin and non-admin version of that account. I'm not going to talk any further about it, but
to go down that rat hole.
Yeah.
Got it.
If you're bypassing the prompt, it doesn't matter what kind the prompt is.
Thanks.
If you are asking about if you're going from standard user and using a credential prompt to run something elevated as a different user account, then yeah, there's still some vulnerabilities there, but there's nothing that, if you never enter the password, there's nothing that a standard user should be able to do that can run something as an admin account without finding some elevation of privilege bug in something else that's already running.
And one thing to keep in mind is if you have the administrator privilege required to do pass the hash, you also have the administrator privilege required to put on a keylogger, a screen scraper. You don't even need to be an admin, but you can also turn on the mic, turn on the camera. There's a lot of things that you can do with that same level of access. You can read and write everything in RAM, which is required for the pass the hash. So it's critical to keep in mind that being an admin means you really own this box. You own everything about it, every piece of RAM, every proc. It's just a matter of whether the tools are there to make it easy to actually exploit that privilege that you have. So one last thing in the demo. You guys want to see it get a little bit worse?
Why not?
We're already here in the hole. Why not? So if you do a WCE-W, and there's a number of tools that do this, including Mimikatz, you can also pull from those running sessions, not from the SAM, but from the running sessions, you can actually pull the plain text passwords. Because those are a set of credentials that are there for the, I want to say it's a digest authentication.
Digest authentication and, encrypts the actual passwords in memory because digest uses passwords. But it has them in memory encrypted, and the tools have figured out how to decrypt it. Yep. Basically, the problem is that anything that the operating system can do, anything that's running as admin can also do it. So if there's encrypted data on the box and the keys to decrypt it, okay, the operating system can do it, so can a malicious admin.
Cool.
Cool. Is that cool? I don't think that's cool.
It is what it is. You got to know what the reality is so you can deal with it. So any other questions on the demo, or is everybody pretty clear on how we got where we got to?
As far as the remoting that you use, did it also include doing remote using MMC?
Yes, anything that uses a network logon type, so MMC, net use, accessing a web page, you know, and doing a network level authentication. Not network level authentication, a network
Windows,
logon type.
Windows authentication to a IIS server uses network logon.
The question was around Kerberos tickets and how they relate. The answer is pass the ticket is theoretically possible. It's just not quite as easy as a pass the hash because the password hash is a direct derivation of the password. The hashes only change when the passwords change or when you smart card enforce account. So they tend to be much longer of value and much more useful. But stealing and reusing a ticket within the ticket's lifetime is also a very valid attack. That WCE program also has early code to do pass the ticket attacks. It's just not something that's used because it's not preferred compared to a pass the hash or a password theft.
Right. But once the attack has been made, Kerberos tickets do limit the window somewhat, but you know you can conduct a complete attack in a lot less than 8 hours. Right. So once the attack has taken place and they've taken over the domain, they can create other ways that don't rely on pass the hash anymore. Once they've gained the target they're after, it doesn't matter anymore.
In the real world, less than 24 hours is pretty common from beginning to end of the pass the hash portion of the attack. We've seen pen testers hit a global multinational in 6 minutes from the first workstation to the end of the story. So it does not take long, as you guys saw in that demo, for this to happen. That was a real-time demo with real tools. And that's the reality we face out there, is that this can happen.
Question over there. Take the mic, please.
This attack's possible with cache credentials as well, right?
That's a great question.
Let's save it for the slide. We have a slide on this one.
We have a slide
on it. We'll get to the cache credentials, or what are commonly called cache credentials, in a couple slides.
Is So the question involved a few different things. One, what can a standard user do to enable this attack? And two, what happens to the credentials if you logged onto that machine and then the machine was rebooted between... Right, so you as a domain admin have logged onto that machine, but then...
Didn't log on yet. The user, I'm shutting down the machine, starting it from scratch. The user is a normal user, can't go to administrator mode, and then I just logged on from boot as administrator. Will the machine, will the attacker catch my credentials?
So if the attacker has compromised the machine and then you reboot the machine before logging on as a domain admin, are you protected? The answer is it depends on what the attacker has done. In most cases, they're going to stay persistent after a reboot because you probably reboot about once a month for patches. And so they usually infect the malware with something that will stay there and will come back up with a machine once it reboots. So in that scenario, rebooting prior to using a domain admin cred is likely not going to make much of a difference.
I will point out, I think one of the aspects of rebooting, though, is LSAS is going to be completely flushed of any credentials it has as part of a reboot. So when it comes up, it's not going to have any of those present unless you've got services and scheduled tasks, you know, configured to run with domain admin accounts.
Yep.
Okay.
So there may be a question in your mind, why can't we just patch this? It relates to the fact that an administrator controls the operating system. They can alter the operating system. Once you have that equivalent of the operating system level of privilege, does everybody remember power users? You ever notice how it kind of went away? It's because it didn't exist. A power user was an admin. There was no way to separate between user-level access and an administrator in an effective way that would stand up to an attacker or to a good security researcher. And once you are admin, you control everything. If that machine is entrusted with those credentials, it doesn't matter how much effort Microsoft puts into hiding it, moving it, encrypting it a different way. The security researcher community and the attackers will find a way to find where that is. Yeah. So from that perspective,
example,
we can't just patch it.
Let's say we come up for Windows 8.1. They change the names of the entry points and the locations of the data where LSAS is keeping the hash.
Encrypt it with a new algorithm.
Right.
All that stuff.
Encrypt it with a new algorithm. Before you are able to finish installing 8.1, WCE will already have been updated because they'll have figured it out. They're really smart people, and they have commoditized this attack mechanism.
And they know it's there.
Basically, it comes down to admin has complete control of the operating system. If the operating system can perform an operation, which, for example, performing single sign-on, you want it to be able to do that. If it can access any data in RAM, then anything running as admin can also do the same. Okay, admin is quote-unquote less powerful than system, but admin can configure anything it wants to run as local system. It can configure anything to run in the kernel. So admin cannot be meaningfully constrained, and this attack requires admin. And once they have accomplished that, then the only thing you can do is prevent them from having anything on that machine worth grabbing that can allow a lateral traversal or privilege escalation to another box.
Mm-hmm. So single sign-on, I think we've covered that at length. Because those credentials have to be there. So to answer the gentleman's question from earlier, this is kind of a reference slide on what credentials and some non-credentials actually are out there and exist on a Windows box. Security Accounts Manager, or SAM database, which is the local authoritative database on every local workstation. If you're still running NT4, it is still a SAM format for the domain, but we've moved on to the ntds.dip file format in Windows 2000. But the SAM database for every workstation has, for the local accounts in it, an NT hash, and depending on the group policy setting, which since Windows Vista and beyond is no LM hashes are stored, it may have an LM hash in it. So for older operating systems or older GPO settings, it may still have an LM hash. LSASS process memory, we saw the NT hash, we saw the LM hash, and we saw the plain text password. That is the treasure trove, but it is only the processes that are running on the box at the time. The Active Directory database has the NT hash for everybody's current password as well as their password history. So if someone nails the Active Directory database and dumps that, then they get all of those hashes for every user and they get to impersonate every user as that account. The credman store, which is effectively when a user saves a password, whatever they save in it can also be pilfered as that user account. They don't even have to be admin. LSA secrets in the registry. You have service accounts that are starting up. Well, the password for the service account needs to be known by the system. Those can be stolen from there. Scheduled tasks are also stored in there. And the NT hash of the computer account is also contained there. Getting to the cache credentials, which is not the correct term. Sometimes they're called cache logons in the GPOs, but they're actually more correctly called the cached logon cache password verifiers. And you wonder why we created a nickname. Those guys are not credentials. What they are is they are a hash of the NT hash that's gone through since FIST and beyond a very long, slow, computationally intensive process. You ever notice when you log on offline, it takes a long time? It's not just looking for the network, it's literally crunching those numbers because it takes that long to generate one hash. And so trying to do a brute force on that is very difficult intentionally. Make sense? So those guys are not credentials. If you see the cache logon count, you see advice, there's some bad advice out there that says lower the cache logon count and you're immune. No, all you're doing is hurting your remote users on their laptops that don't have a DC that's on the network. And that's all you're doing is hurting them. You're not affecting the pass the hash at all.
Yep. They're used to verify, does the user know the credential, but it doesn't include the hash.
Yep. So finally, we have, about a half hour left? Yep. We are to the mitigation section. So what can you do about this problem? The white paper that we're referencing, which is out there on the web, you look for pass the hash white paper, you'll find it, recommends three mitigations. And these are the three easiest. That doesn't mean that they're all easy, but they're the three easiest mitigations to deal with the biggest parts of this problem. The first is that elevation of privilege, making sure that the admin credentials that are on those that control the domain are not exposed to those lower trust machines. They're simply not there. They can't be stolen because they are not there. And it goes through how to set up an admin workstation if you so choose. You can always walk up to the physical DC console and just log in to the DCs, but most people want to have an admin workstation. And so that has the instructions step by step on how to set that up, how to set up the GPOs, and how to configure that.
Basically, number one rule, don't use domain admin for workstation administration. Don't install software that says you configure this service with the domain admin account on workstations. That's the high-level bullet, and then obviously also want any other highly privileged accounts to not have their credentials show up on end-user workstations or other lower-value systems.
Yeah, because when you have a credential that controls something like the whole domain and you log on to something else with that credential, you are granting whoever owns that machine control of that credential and therefore of everything it controls. So you have to set up that tier of trust where what is controlling the domain is not entrusted to a lower security host. Next piece is to mitigation two, to restrict and protect those admins with local privileges. Effectively make sure that those local admin accounts on each of the boxes cannot be used. So if I own one box as a bad guy, I'm not going to be able to get a credential that I can use on the other workstations. There's a whole plethora of choices there. I believe there's three or four of them, one of which is a user account control piece. We're going to cover that in just a moment. Another is to randomize the password so that it's a different password on each workstation. Another is logon restrictions. But ultimately, if I own that one box, the stuff I get from there can't let me go and own the other boxes that are similarly configured. And that's the principle of that second one. The third one is actually, it doesn't just affect the local accounts. For workstations, you can turn on the Windows firewall and block all inbound traffic except for help desk management workstations, any push management servers that actually reach out and push to the clients, anybody that needs to remote control those clients. There's a few authorized exceptions in most environments that you can let through, but otherwise you can block all inbound on a workstation. Servers, it gets a little trickier, so you have to look at things a little bit differently. But on a workstation, most of the time, unless you've got like a link peer-to-peer call or Skype or something like that, those workstations don't need to be talking to each other. And so you can block the inbound traffic. And that protects you against domain account theft and reuse as well as local account. The middle one there only protects you against local account. Make sense? You want to take this one?
You go ahead.
Okay. I'm getting you back for the whole book thing, you know. So this mitigation, like I said before, the big thing that it does is it establishes secure hosts. It's not the most convenient thing in the world, because when it comes down to it, if you want a workstation at your desk where you do domain admin work, you need to have a separate one that you do email at, because that one that you do email at and that has all the phishing links coming in and you're hitting all the watering hole potential sites and all that, you know, that risk and the domain admin credentials cannot mix. So you may end up having two workstations on your desktop. It doesn't have to be two desktops or two laptops. It can be a separate tablet machine. It can be a Windows to Go stick. As long as you have a known good secured OS that's locked down at the level of the DC, then you're good to go. And for the most part, quite honestly, most people don't need to be doing domain admin work on a day-to-day basis. It's something they can delegate down to a lower privilege account. And so there are different ways of addressing that. But ultimately, that has a step-by-step on how to set up the OUs, the GPOs, to make sure that those domain admins don't accidentally log on to those lower trust machines. Make sense?
How many of you have separate, how many of you are in organizations where your admins have, your domain admins have separate accounts for their day-to-day email, web, et cetera? That's good. That's very good.
Cool. Very cool. So you guys are on the path. That's the first step, is separate out your user tasks from your admin tasks, and then, you know, set up the rest of the pieces for it. So that's mitigation one. I apologize, we don't have any snazzy graphics for these mitigations. Mitigation two. This is protecting those local accounts. You want to take a shot?
Sure, I'll do this one. So we saw earlier how local accounts that are configured the same across a bunch of different boxes can allow lateral traversal very easily. We also saw how anything with admin rights can extract the hash, even if the account is not being used, can extract the hash out of the SAM, the Security Accounts Manager database, and just start using it to go across the wire. So what we want to do is restrict that. There's a couple different ways to do that. One is, like Mark said, create random passwords for all of them so they don't have the same password everywhere. Unfortunately, Microsoft does not currently ship any easy way to make that happen. In fact, we ship stuff in group policy preferences to give you the same password everywhere and change it the same everywhere, which, okay, I like my job. I'm not going to say anything else about that.
Step off the soapbox. That is correct. The SECM OSD process does, I believe, even by default, randomize the passwords on each workstation, to our credit.
Okay. That's good to know. I'll write that down. Yay, oh. Microsoft. where was I going with that one? There are, by the way, third-party companies, some of whom, at least one of whom, is present here at this at TechEd this week, that have products that do password management and can handle that for you. Another one, though, that's actually much simpler to implement is that beginning in Windows Vista with user account control, you know what user account control, when you log on with an account that is a member of a powerful group or has admin equivalent privileges, it creates two LSA sessions for that account, one representing the account with full rights, you know, full administrative rights, and the other filtered token that represents the user running basically a standard user. And you know, when you log on, you start interacting, everything runs as a standard user account. Well, what does it do over the network? When you're using a local account and authenticating over the network, Windows Vista, Windows 7, Windows 8 will authenticate that user account and represent it on that machine with the standard user version of the token, the filtered token. So basically, this has the effect of blocking the use of local accounts for remote administration. And the way that is turned off, because that breaks a lot of stuff and a lot of assumptions that people have had for decades, is a registry value called local account token filter policy. And if you search for local account token filter policy, you will find tons of web pages saying, create this value, set it to one, and everything starts to work again. And what that means is now you can do remote administration using local accounts and set yourself up for a pass the hash attack.
We've seen a lot of network scanners, a lot of even security software, anything that has an agent that wants to push and to use that common local admin password typically tells you to turn that off. And it's something that turning that off opens you up to the attackers using that exact same vector.
Right. So we're starting to promote a security policy that says make sure local account token filter policy is not disabled. Okay, so that that filtering does take place, and now pass the hash doesn't work if you can't gain admin control of the remote machine. And this will block admin accounts or local accounts from being used for that, with one exception, which is the built-in administrator account, if it's enabled by default, doesn't have UAC filtering applied to it. If you've ever logged on using the built-in administrator account, you've noticed everything runs with admin rights. Unless you change the security policy that says, yes, apply UAC token filtering to the built-in administrator as well. And we're recommending in our updated security guidance, yes, turn that on as well, so that all local accounts are subject to UAC.
And by the way, the detail, you don't have to remember all these words. They are in the white paper with detailed step-by-step instructions on exactly which GPOs to turn on. So all that is listed out for each of these three main mitigations.
And finally, the third one there in the middle is to use the policy to say remote desktop and network access is denied for the local accounts. You enumerate the local accounts and you put them in the deny policy in the local security policy, and that will block them from accessing it at all using local accounts. Mm-hmm. Click.
Questions? Then the third mitigation that we recommend, and again, all these are documented fully in a click-by-click basis and some screenshots of my machines. I was a co-author. Turn on the Windows Firewall. The Windows Firewall is turned on by default, but it is something that is turned on and allows a number of different authenticated inbound connections. Those particular services are secure against attack. They're reviewed by the SDL. They've done threat modeling. They've done code review. And so the inbound server service that allows you to connect in is pretty secure. However, what we don't want is we don't want legitimate connections coming in. And that's where this white paper has stepped it up beyond the normal Windows defaults, is we actually block, unless you come from an IP that we know needs to be talking to that client, then you cannot talk to this client. Typical scenarios are if you have an older management server, I think the old versions of Tivoli used to do it, where it actually pushes everything. Scanning software, so if you have something that scans for vulnerabilities and goes and hits the admin dollar sign and looks for the file versions and all that, those guys need to be authorized to be able to do their job. So you know, usually it's one or two IPs, a scanning workstation or a scanning server. So there's a couple of authorized scenarios where you have an inbound exception, but for the most part, things don't need to be connecting to the workstations on a peer-to-peer basis. We did actually discover through the course of this guidance that we kind of forgot one product that Microsoft puts out, Link, does have peer-to-peer bandwidth efficiency stuff. And so we took a look at that scenario and we made an honest assessment, which is, okay, if you don't take normal Windows credentials like the NT hashes and the Kerberos tickets and the plain text password, if that service that's listening doesn't accept those, it's not a pass the hash risk. If the application itself doesn't have credentials that can be stolen and reused for that purpose, then it's not a credential theft and reuse risk. So we in an update that should be posting either today or tomorrow, the white paper will include guidance that discusses that scenario and provides security guidance for that particular scenario. But that was something that we didn't catch before the first release. Also in the white paper, beyond those three main recommendations, which are these are the first three things that you should be looking at working on, and honestly, if you put those three mitigations in place and implement those in your organization, you're going to be heads and tails above the general ecosystem in terms of resiliency to these attacks. Putting those things in place will make you, it won't be perfect, but it will put you way ahead of the game in terms of what the attackers can do on your network. You will disrupt their current operations significantly and force them into figuring out new ways of doing things because their standard practices are not compatible with those defenses. So there's some additional recommendations, and we had the opportunity to put those in there, that we think are extremely valuable. The first is taking those users out of that local admin group, because that creates a puts a operating system level security boundary between a user click and being able to start past the hash. If not, it's just whatever the application has for security stuff to prevent from doing it, and that could be clicking yes in IE, or you know, just exploiting a particular application vulnerability such as an IE plugin. But putting that in there gets you a security boundary between that one erroneous click and then starting this type of attack. So we really like that recommendation.
Yeah, I'm, for those who've known of me before past the hash and sysinternals, standard user running a standard user, getting out of admin is something I've been passionate about since 2001, I think. But this doesn't actually block past the hash, but it does help block the avenue by which the attacker gains the ability to start past the hash. Okay?
The next one is a numbers game. The less domain admins you have, the less you use them, the less likely that the bad guys will be able to find it. The less admins that you have in general, if they don't, it's just following the principle of least privilege. The less admin rights that you have, the less that they're used, the more they're delegated down, the less of a chance that they're going to get something that they can use to get to their goal. The harder they're going to have to work, the more logs that they're going to have to put in your event logs of the tracks as they're trying to figure this out. So less admins is definitely a very good thing. The last two are kind of along the same lines, which is don't do normal end-user tasks like web browsing and email with an admin or an elevated privilege account, because that takes away that separation between those two different kinds of tasks, which have very different risk profiles and very different usage profiles. So don't give them internet access and don't give them email accounts. Some additional recommendations. If you can, use network logons. Use an MMC to manage your Active Directory or to manage your Exchange server, because that's creating less exposure of credentials to be spread around. So the less that you use, the less that are there to be stolen.
This is what we talked about earlier. Network logons do not put reusable credentials on the remote machines that you're connecting to. So MMC snap-ins, at least the ones we looked at, tend to just use network logons. So computer management, you can put in a remote computer. It uses network logon, not credential logon of some type.
Yep. And the white paper has a very good reference. I think it's about 3 or 4 pages long of all the popular logon tools that we're aware of, or excuse me, management tools we're aware of, and when they do and don't expose credentials at the remote end. We even have it down to PS exec with this switch versus this switch, a PowerShell remote versus this switch. So we have quite a good reference in there that took a lot of research, so please take advantage of that. If you're investigating a computer that you think is compromised, don't use a domain admin account to do it. Use a local administrator account or something that doesn't give a bad guy something else. It's kind of common sense, but it's worth mentioning. Yep. Patch. If you have an operating system security boundary, or an application security boundary that's put in place, the way that that is maintained is patching. If not, if you do not patch, you are creating you have a fence that has a known hole in it. And when we say known hole, how many people caught the big session yesterday about all the different hacker tools? Okay, cool. You guys remember that hacker tool that had that huge library of known attacks?
Metasploit.
You are subject, if you're not patching, to potentially all of those. Because what's happening is that there's a known free attack that comes with every tool. They do not have to put the effort and the money into finding a zero day or buying a zero day. They can just use something that's out there in the tools that exist. You have to patch, because patching keeps you up to date with what those guys are able to do. Patch is very critical.
Does the guys have a patch Tuesday for the tools?
The question is, do the guys have a patch Tuesday for the tools? I think I'll just not answer that question. I don't know. A point here is secure and manage your domain controllers. Your DCs are, from an IT perspective, the crown jewels of your environment. They are the gateways to controlling all the accounts that have access to everything. Make sure you're doing your due diligence on those. Don't let people browse the internet on them. Make sure the firewalls are up to date. Do your basic due diligence, because that is the pivot point of the security of an Active Directory domain. And if you have a password management tool like a Lieberman software or a CyberArk or something like that, treat those like it's a DC, because they have the same level of access, and make sure you're providing that same due diligence for them. But those are the high-value hosts that have that gateway of access to everything. Remove LM hashes. If you've still got an old GPO setting, or if you reversed it for an old application, turn it back on, get rid of the LM hashes, try and cycle those user passwords so that those old LM hashes go away, because they are so trivial to crack. The NT hashes are getting easier and easier to crack as well, but the LM hashes are a joke in terms of being able to reverse them. How are we doing on time? So this is kind of a bit of a myth-buster section. There are a lot of things that people think are going to be a magic bullet for pass the hash. And while these do have some security value in different contexts, these are not going to have a direct impact on pass the hash itself. First of all, disabling NTLM going all Kerberos, that's a good thing. It gets you into, you know, credentials that are only good for a period of time versus as good for as long as the password is good. There's a lot of benefits to disabling NTLM, but it's also very hard and very expensive. When you talk about your printers on your network that are integrated in AD and all these various different devices and applications, there's a lot of them that are dependent on NTLM that you're not aware of. So that's a very good thing to be doing, and it's a good long-term piece, but it's not something that affects pass the hash, because they can switch to pass the ticket in a heartbeat and still work within that 8 to 10 hour ticket window. Smart cards, like we mentioned earlier, they're not a panacea for pass the hash, but if you do have secure hosts, that you get what you were promised by the sales guy. But you have to have a secure host to operate from. If the host is compromised, where those two factors go down to one, then they don't do you much good.
I should point out the downside of smart cards, though, and that is that if you have smart card required, the hash remains the same forever. Okay, so the password hash, if you have a password on the account and you're changing the password, every time you change the password, the hash has now changed as well. And that hash can no longer be used. If someone had saved off the hash earlier, that hash is no longer valuable. In the case of smart card required, that hash remains constant. And that can be used for years.
Question?
Can you schedule a task to reset the passwords every day on the smart card required accounts? We have actually been investigating this.
That's something that we've got scripted, and we're working with a couple of customers to prove out and make sure it doesn't have any side effects. One thing we have discovered is when you turn that bit off and on the account, that it tends to kill all the active sessions.
And that's why
we haven't figured out exactly why, and until we understand exactly why, we're not going to recommend it. But it does have security benefits if you do want to kill that session. So. That's something we're still finishing our testing on.
Yeah, but you need daily is aggressive. If you do it every month, though, and every month, you know, you've got something critical that your employee, your soldier, whoever is using a smart card is doing, and that just happens to be the time when his smart card hash is suddenly invalidated, that can be very disruptive. So we need to find a way to do this where it doesn't disrupt active work that's going on.
And additionally, you have to know where the account will be used. Because if everybody's in the same city, well, 3 a.m. is 3 a.m. If you've got a global multinational with Follow the Sun, 3 a.m. might hit you in the middle of the day. So you have to it's a brute force sort of technique, and so you have to kind of work with it. But it is a valid approach. The next piece we wanted to talk about was jump servers. Jump servers is basically an RDP server where you jump up and you log into a normal workstation, you hit the jump server, and you log in with your domain admin creds. That can protect you against pass the hash.
How many of you are familiar with this term? Because, for those of you who aren't, basically it could be described as you've got two segmented networks and you've got this server that's connected to both of them. You log on using remote desktop to the first server, which is your jump server, and from there, you can access things on the other network, right? So you typically do remote desktop, and then from there, another remote desktop. Go ahead, sorry.
Yep. And so when you talk about doing that jump server concept where I log on and I type in my domain admin creds, you are doing an elevation of privilege. You are also typing that password, if it's a password-based account, into a low-trust workstation. So if someone has a keylogger, they've got the string of characters, and they're done. So it doesn't address the pass the hash or the credential theft problem very effectively. It can be very effective as a security tool. So say we have an online services environment, like where we have, this is our web server farm, and this is our day-to-day IT operations. Well, the only people that are going to go into the back end of the services farm have to go through a jump server. Well, I've got one place to look for logs, and I've only got to, you know, set my alerting and my monitoring for that one place. It makes sense as a choke point. There's a lot of security value for a jump server. But if you make it an elevation of privilege path, you have to be very, very careful that the bad guy can't follow that. And typically, in most cases, they can. Rebooting, which ties into the gentleman's question from earlier. Rebooting will get rid of all of the SaaS passwords there. Sometimes you have an application that doesn't quite close every handle or all the various pieces, and it causes the credentials to linger in memory long after the session should be gone. Rebooting will get rid of that, but it is not a strategy you can build on, because if they're there with that WC.E, bam, it's gone in that heartbeat. Make sense? So with all these things in place, is the problem solved? Answer is no. These are what you can do today with the current products that are released and the current features that are there, period. That's the intent of that white paper, and it is to get you going and to provide a significant defense against what we see out there on a day-to-day basis for the attacks. And this will get you in a much, much better place, but this is not the end of the story by any means. I can't disclose any other details, but we are working on the problem. Make sense? So I have done through the course of a number of
questions.
Oh, I'm sorry. The question was, is this a Windows-specific problem, or is this something that other operating systems has solved? The short answer to that is that it is not really Windows-specific. Root has the same access as system, and so you'd face those same kind of problems. The only thing that is particularly interesting about Windows is that we do accept the password hash as a credential. That's the only thing that's unusual about it, but other than that, it's pretty much the same as every operating system. If you get root, you get system, you get everything typed into it, you get everything stored on it, you get the MD5s of the password hashes, if that's what it's stored in your, what is it, the shadow, Etsy shadow password. I can't even remember the terms right offhand. But the same principles apply. Our biggest problem as Microsoft is that we have a massive market share. Almost everybody runs AD, and so the tools are extremely mature. We're a high-value target for them. So we've got a few minutes left, and I've got kind of two things. One is a call to action. Please read the white paper if you haven't already. Please implement mitigations 1 through 3 if you can, as far as you can, because that will put you in a much, much better position against these targeted attacks. Spread the word. Share it. You know, help your friends and colleagues and neighbors and everyone you can on this. If you have any questions, my email address and a hopefully won't get too much spam type of format when they post these slides on the web is there, so you're welcome to contact me directly. If you have any questions, I am part of the Pass the Hash work group. We are continuing to work on this problem. And if you guys are interested, we do have a few more minutes, and I can talk a little bit about some advanced architectures that our consulting team does, or we could take questions.
Go ahead and click.
Everybody want to see the advanced architectures? Cool. So this is something that our team puts out that's called Enhanced Security Admin Environment. And you'll notice some of the themes in here are fairly common to the defenses in the white paper. Mitigation 1 is a very simplified version of this architecture. So we take the current production environment, you know, each given domain, we divide it into those three levels. Domain controllers, servers, and workstations. We arbitrarily assign those different trust levels to it. We call the top tier 0, servers tier 1, and the workstations tier 2. We set up credential partitioning, just like in the white paper. Make sure that the logon restrictions are there so that the domain admins can't log into servers or workstations. The server admins cannot log on to workstations. Additionally, we set up an administrative forest. This gets us a couple different things, one of which is the ability to use a trust feature called selective authentication. Because the group policy objects are self-enforced on the machine, because the machine is the one that's saying you can or cannot log on to me, there is a level of, you know, a limited lifetime to when the attackers will figure out how to get around that. The selective authentication feature on the trust is actually enforced at the DC level, which gets us a nice benefit that if the server is compromised and the admin accidentally tries to log into the server as a domain admin, then it is enforced at the DC level, and then the attacker can't work around that. The other thing that we get in that admin environment is a known good trusted environment. So even if the domain is compromised, then we know we have known good hosts where these domain admins are logging in and known good accounts. Speaking of known good accounts and known good hosts, we set up dedicated hosts. Again, can be Windows to go, laptop, desktop, doesn't matter. We let them out of the IPsec bubble because there is an IPsec virtual boundary around there that does not allow any inbound or outbound traffic that is not pre-authorized to that admin forest. We set up domain admin accounts that live in there. We call them gold cards. These are domain admins in production, but they are users in the admin forest. And that allows us to enforce policy on them. It also allows us to do monitoring and a bunch of other things to them that they cannot tamper with as their own accounts. They don't need that permission over their own accounts or over their peers. And so we have a degree of control and policy enforcement over those accounts, whether they're the legitimate users doing them or the bad guys that have managed to steal a copy of their credential. We set the whole environment up to auto-patch. So it will automatically patch and automatically reboot. Worst case scenario is the domain admin is doing something on patch Tuesday or the 3 a.m. after patch Tuesday on Wednesday morning, and their machine reboots or the DC reboots and they have to log in again. But they are never unpatched in this particular scenario. We also set up an alerting system on SCOM, our System Center Operations Manager product, and we have a management pack that knows about a whole bunch of different things, like the domain admin group changed, a service was installed on a DC. I can't remember all of them offhand. One of the built-in admin accounts was used, which is not used in this model. Any of those will trigger an alert, page the admin, we need to go look at things. So all that is built into the architecture, and all of the admin accounts for the admin environment are offline. There are no online admins. Hence, we now have tamper-resistant auditing because anything that goes into that red forest is not erasable by the admins or by the bad guys if they happen to steal those admin accounts from a defense in-depth perspective. And because frequently organizations have an application agent, that is, you know, it's like SCCM or SCOM or some other management agent that lives in the production environment at the server layer and has an agent on the DCs and effectively allows that lower trust resource to control the higher trust resource, we take a look and we do analysis to make sure that that is not violating the boundary. So we either take the agent off or we increase the hardening and trust around the DCs. And we also do lateral traversal protections, whatever makes sense. So that's kind of an example of the extreme that you can go to make sure that those domain admins never fall into the hands of the bad guys. Or if they do, we know about it quickly, and the credentials expire quickly. Any questions?
So the question is about run as and using a domain admin account on the machine where you're doing run as. There's several things you're doing. One, in the user session, say you're running as a standard user, anything that is monitoring the keystrokes, you could have standard user software monitoring the keystrokes or spying on the run as exit process. It's going to see all the credentials. So now whatever is able to control that session now has those credentials. Okay. In addition, I'm sorry? Is it susceptible to pass the hash? Well, you've given up the password to begin with, but run as normally, if you just do run as with, I think, most of the different options, yes, you're getting an interactive logon. If you do run as slash network, I believe you're getting a network logon only. I haven't used run as in a while. I do know this document
in the white paper. I remember looking at it as it went
yeah,
by.
Yeah, it is definitely in the white paper.
Fundamentally, a normal run as, though, is just as vulnerable to a normal operation that you're running. So whether you log in locally or you log in as a different account and then run as, both of those credentials can be stolen in the same way. Yeah. LSS doesn't differentiate because it automatically assumes you're going to go, depending on the command line switch.
One minor thing, I mean, run as is particularly vulnerable. I created a script called Make Me Admin back in the XP days that allowed you to have a standard user account, and bouncing out of a local admin account would allow you to run something as you with admin rights. And it influenced the development of UAC. UAC did it better, though, because when you enter the credentials there, you're doing it under something completely under the control of the system account, as opposed to using the run as exe, which is under the control of anything running in that standard user space. So, yeah, I haven't used run as in ages because of that.
So
I think we're running out of time. We would be happy to take questions up here. Please, if you enjoyed the session, please fill out an eval. If you didn't enjoy the session, come talk to us instead.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I hope it was valuable.